Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
We understand that some of our listeners may be disturbed or suffer some mental illness due to the nature of these episodes. A listener of ours, Rob Lewis, has this message that he would like to send out. Rob Lewis is the founder and manager of the Depression and Suicide Support Illawarra and Sydney Facebook group. A message from him.
I have been at rock bottom. I have felt no one was there. I have felt alone. I tried to end it all more than once. But now I see when I told people I was fine, they believed me. The hardest part of depression is feeling like if you ask for help, you're going to burden someone you care about. But in all honesty, the biggest problem is people don't talk about depression. Please feel free to share this group with anyone who needs help. That group is the Depression and Suicide Support Illawarra and Sydney Facebook page. Once again, if you would like support, head to Facebook, the Depression and Suicide Support Group Illawarra and Sydney Facebook page. And now, on to the show.
A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man. And that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Gawky, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Soul. Joining me for another episode of the weird, wonderful sometimes, horrific other times, is, of course, our researcher extraordinaire, Holly Soul.
Hey, guys.
Also important to remember that this episode is also edited and produced by Blake Kell.
So blame him if we sound like crap.
Or give him a thumbs up. If we sound amazing.
That too.
Yeah. So this is part three in the conclusion to our series. Look, we're going to be perfectly honest with you folks. Not only has this series been, it's been hard. You know, I think it's been an emotional roller coaster for us and, of course, you guys. But today it was announced that the ACT is now introducing further COVID restrictions and we also live in New South Wales. New South Wales was the first to cop the COVID restrictions. And while the rest of the world is getting vaccinated and getting out of lockdowns, Australia is about to go straight back into one due to basic failings of state and federal government. So we're going to do our best to be professional. To get through this conclusion, to do it in the same way that we would do every single episode. But if we seem a little down or a little low, that's the reason why. So I thought I'd talk about that at the head of the podcast. Of course, if you're listening to this in Australia, you're going through exactly the same thing that we all are. So what we will say quite clearly, wash those hands, use that hand sanitizer, slap on a mask. We love all of you. So keep those three things in mind. We'll get through this together again.
That was four, but I appreciate the sentiment.
What was the fourth one?
You said clean your hands, sanitize, wear a mask, and we love you. That's four things to remember.
All right, then, four things to remember. Right, keep that in the back of your head. We're wearing masks. You're going to encounter people who aren't. Keep a wide berth, and you just do the right thing. Follow our example. We'll do the right thing. You guys do the right thing. We'll make it through this. So we just got to have each other's back. Let's show everyone what the Aussie spirit's all about.
If we make it through all this shit, we'll do a fun one next week. Promise.
Well, we will make it through this one, and we will do a fun one next week. Don't even have to put any maybes to it. All right. Now, as we jump into this, we're going to be talking about the last of a few notable cases in the Sydney Cliff murders, and we're also going to cover some of the amazing journalists and investigators and people who have pushed incredibly hard to make this their mission and to bring justice to these victims. So without further ado, Holly, take it away.
Before we go into more cases surrounding the Sydney Cliff murders, I want to look into the people and the strike force that actually helped to uncover the links. Operation Parabel, sometimes called Strike Force Parabel, was initially created simply to
bring the New South Wales police force and the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex and queer community closer together by doing all that is possible from this point forward in history.
And that's from the police actual specific page for Strike Force Parabel.
Yeah, they're basically saying that this incident has marred the police force, it's marred the reputation, and it's damaged the links between law enforcement and the LGBT community. And so they see that correcting this error is a possible way to start broaching a reconciliation between the two groups.
Parabel was launched following a submission to the Australian Institute of Criminology in 2013. Experts from Flinders University were used to scrutinise the results and make sure the police were not trying to hide anything in their submissions. All up, Parabel examined 88 cases that took place between 1976 and 2000. They discovered outright bias in 27 of those cases, and 23 cases overall remain unsolved.
This is a very interesting way of looking at accountability. And it's funny that we start talking about this because right now I've just finished editing 1/4 of Weird Crap in Australia Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing that I edited was it was Hoddle Street, Queen Street, and the third Melbourne case we covered in Year 2. Which was another shooting. I can't remember. Was it what? No. Wall Street.
Wall Street was the next one, I think.
Yeah. Queen Street, Hoddle Street, Wall Street. And in that chapter and in that episode of the podcast, we talked a lot about police corruption. We talked a lot about accountability issues. I apologize for Joker. He's being very needy at the moment. If you're a new listener, Joker and Talia are our executive producers, aka our feline companions. And every now and again, they like to make themselves known.
Running criticism.
Yeah, running criticism as we speak. So it is very interesting to see that when the New South Wales Strike Force was formed and, you know, they were looking at things like accountability, they looked to, you know, essentially a university outfit to run a study while they were investigating. I find that very, very interesting. And I almost wonder if this is the first time this has occurred around the world.
Well, at the very least, it was designed to keep the police from being accused of further bias further down the line because they have the third-party mediator.
Yeah, you'll never hear me complain about accountability. I think it's incredibly important.
Overall, out of this, 8 cases were deemed to be absolutely the result of a gay hate attack, with another 19 suspected of being gay hate. Of the other 59, there was little to no evidence of whether they were gay hate attacks, if there was any evidence at all left to the cases, because some of them were just, oh yeah, nah, suicide, throw it out. There were 12 recommendations made within the final report, including updating policies and information systems and bringing in specialists to oversee every homicide investigation, not just the ones the police wanted them to. To our knowledge, these recommendations were actually followed through.
And we saw this when we, you know, when we discussed in our first episode. It was a case of the beat cops didn't want to pursue these as murders, whereas the detectives absolutely did. Because I think it would be disingenuous not to give credit to some detectives working in the 1980s who, you know, they didn't bring their bias to work. They came to work. They were like, we suspect that this is a homicide. We would like to pursue it. And the police culture at the time prevented them from doing it. There were good cops. Even when I've brought this up in correlation to what's occurred here, I brought up the Victorian child abuse cover-up. There were also good cops there. There are always great elements to every organization, just as there are, you know, rough elements or criminal elements to organizations. So it's also important to remember there were detectives trying to do their job.
Yeah. The submissions made to the inquiry included investigations made by Miss Sue Thompson, the police gay-lesbian liaison officer, with help from Professor Stephen Thompson.
Sue Thompson, a former long-time gay and lesbian client consultant to the New South Wales Police, has estimated that between 1989 and 1999, there were at least 46 gay hate murders in New South Wales. This assessment is supported by a study published more than a decade ago titled Hatred, Murder and Male Honour by a criminologist, Stephen Thompson, published in 2002 by the Australian Institute of Criminology. Thompson concluded that there were 50 gay hate murders in New South Wales between 1985 and 1995 inclusive.
And that was from the Sydney Morning Herald, Gay Hate, The Shameful Crime Wave. It's really disturbing the fact that you can pick any 10 years between the 70s and the 2000s and you'll get more than 50.
Yeah, it is very, very disturbing.
Thompson and Thompson were not the only people. Yes.
Sorry.
I knew you were going to do this as soon as I wrote it.
Yeah. So this is something that happened when I was actually going through the notes. Now, there are two detectives in the Tintin comics. Their names are Thompson and Thompson, aren't they? Yeah.
One with a H and one without a H.
Hello, Thompson. Hello, Thompson. And I'm sure these two cop that all the time.
Probably, yeah.
So, yes, probably the only moment of levity in this episode as well, but it did make me slightly chuckle because I thought of Tintin and his dog Snowy, and he was always trying to solve crimes,
yes,
wasn't
he? Yes, he was. So were the Thompsons in their own way.
Yeah. Did you know Tintin was actually based on a real person?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, he was based on an adventuring Boy Scout. Yeah.
Okay. Thompson and Thompson were a little bit more credible than the Thompsons we were just talking about.
Yeah, they're incompetent boobs in Tintin. These people are actually very good at their jobs,
yes,
just have
they are.
Unfortunate naming schemes.
They weren't the only people investigating what was going on. Detective Sergeant Steve McCann filed a report in August 1991 linking the murder of 31-year-old Richard Johnson to a spate of six other murders and or assaults in the area around the time. Now, we'll actually cover Richard's case in a little bit. Because of his intention to actually investigate the crimes, he was nicknamed the Gay Avenger by his colleagues. And by all accounts, that was not a compliment.
No, it doesn't sound like a compliment at all.
Because macho men.
This guy is fighting for justice.
He's fighting, one of those guys who enters the police force with stars in his eyes. Yeah. He's going to make the world a better place.
He's fighting for victims. You know, if I was to name him after an Avenger, I'd call him Captain Australia because he obviously has the morality of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be my nickname for him. Or champion or absolute bloody legend.
McCann was eventually forced out of the police force by his colleagues, but not before inspiring others to pick up the torch. His report was taken over by Detective Sergeant Steve Page in 2000, and he launched Operation Tarradale.
Operation Tarradale would uncover multiple failures in police investigations, but the operation had only been set up after persistent allegations by Kay Warren, whose son, Ross, 25, had gone missing at Marks Park's Tamarama.
Yeah.
Thank you, Holly. In 1989, his body was never found.
And that was also from the Sydney Morning Herald article.
You know, and again, like, courage to that detective. Again, 2000, not that long ago,
no.
But still very rough for members of the LGBT community. And, you know, I know this because only a few years, well, I think 2003, I've brought it up before, but my very good friend would come out And, you know, we saw, thankfully, we didn't see things like this. And I'm very grateful for that, you know, but we did encounter things every now and again, you know, very hateful things. So, you know, people like to think this is all in the past. It's not as far removed as people think it is.
I'm pretty sure it's even still going now if you pick the right day and the right time.
And the right place, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's with the information presented to the inquiry by Sue Thompson and Stephen Thompson, and the investigation built on the back of the work of Detective Sergeant Steve McCann and Stephen Page, that the idea of an inquest ever got off the ground, and it's only because of that inquest that Steve Johnson's murder was fixed. Was solved.
Yeah. Or at least.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They have a culprit and the trial will occur.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's just, we just wanted to, before we covered the most infamous cases, because we left it about halfway through last week, we did want to stress that, you know, it's always important to show a full spectrum of what goes on. And to suggest that every single cop was a bad cop, again, would be disingenuous to heroes who took it upon themselves to push for these cases, to push for these victims, who some lost careers over this. So it's really, really important to not acknowledge those good works. Now we're going to continue with what where we left it last week. We're going to start looking at the last of the most infamous cases as we wrap up and conclude the series.
Now, for those of you who remember, the last case we covered was John Russell. Around 3 a.m. on July 21st, 1990, three assailants killed 34-year-old Thai man Krichikorn Ratanja Asaborn. I think that's how I wrote it out.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you took a crack at that because I'm not even going to attempt it.
Ratanja Asaborn. That's how I've written it out. He was attacked 7 months after John Russell. Three boys waited for a victim at the top of a cliff near Marks Park, very close to where John was attacked. They set upon a pair of men out for a walk. One of the men was knocked out and cast aside. The other was beaten severely with their improvised weapons. One of the attackers was using a claw hammer. Krichikorn was thrown over the edge where he hit the stone below, leaving behind his sunglasses, his watch with a broken band, and a blue handkerchief covered in blood. Blood patches covered stone of the lookout where they sunk in as reminders for the months after the attack.
The court documents record that the severely beaten man fell onto a rock ledge several metres below, out of our sight from the cliff top. Vomit and blood and a letter from his mother were found here. Then he fell to a second ledge. Then he fell again, this time into the sea. He was still alive when he fell into the water. If rescue services had been called in at 8 a.m. on Saturday, when we were standing at the top of the cliff with the two police officers, he may have been found alive. What's important to note here, I find this very interesting from... God, how many murders have we probably covered in these 3 years? Tons, at least 20, 30 now?
Yeah, something like that.
Unfortunately, when all that information is running around in your head, and I mean, don't be too sympathetic towards this, we've done this to ourselves, you start to pick up on patterns and you start to see evidence, you know, not in the same way that a detective would, but you can sort of see hints to how crimes played out. At least I can, unfortunately. The fact that there was vomit on the ground meant that he was probably beaten to the point of vomiting. So he was in incredible pain.
Or kicked in the stomach to the point where he just involuntary retching.
Yep. So that's something to think about here. So you've got premeditation and torture. The other thing that I find quite interesting here is the fact that the handkerchief was covered in blood. This could mean one or two things. Either the attackers stopped long enough for the victim to feel comfortable enough that he was going to be let go, that he decided to start cleaning his wounds. That's a possibility. Or they let him walk away. He thought he was free. And then his assailants grabbed him and threw him over the cliff. Regardless, this man was tortured. And when they, you know, could manage it, they tried to, you know, terrorize him one last time before his death. So, unfortunately, that's what the evidence suggests here to me.
The handkerchief was actually found blowing in the wind off one of the little trees off to the side of the path. So there is a third option in that it just fell out of his clothes and got bloody when it was blowing around.
Possible, but I would say that it's more probable, you know, the previous two options.
Still going to offer it as a theory.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we don't, no one knows. So it's like, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, his friend was knocked out and thrown out of the way, so he wouldn't know either. Critchicorn's disappearance and the blood all around the rocks, the lookout, and on the path would not be investigated for a full 24 hours after the police were first called in. When witnesses returned to the lookout on their nightly walks, including Michael Connor, who we just heard from before, they found no signs of an investigation. There was no tape, no officers, no security.
We went towards Temamarema and, stepping off the path, examined the rough area above the cliff. Within minutes, we found a Medicare receipt and several plastic cards in the shrubs. This may have been in the vicinity of where television newsreader Ross Warren is assumed to have gone missing exactly 12 months before. Again, we called the police. This time the investigation got serious. We were told they traced the Bondi owner of the cards and found him in bed, severely beaten.
Well, that was most certainly a lie. Police divers were brought in and Critchicorn's body was dragged from the depths. Witnesses in the area at the time of the beating, as well as information from informants and the perpetrator's bragging, led them to arrest three boys for the crime, dubbed the Temarema Three: Matthew Davis and brothers Sean and David McAuliffe.
A school friend of theirs made a statement at the committal hearing, saying one had boasted about what he'd done shortly after the crime. The defendant came up to me and said, "Guess what? We beat this slap Asian," she said. He continued on, saying, "See the blood on my shoe? I was kicking him in the head."
And that comes from the Star Observer, Sydney Gay Beat Murders Revealed.
Isn't it interesting here? So we're dealing with one or two things. We're either dealing with a pack of homophobe murderers, or we're dealing with a pack of racists, or the third option is that we're dealing with a pack of murderous homophobic racists.
I'd say option C.
And that's why, you know, in the last episode, I speculated that this could possibly be the movements of neo-Nazis or white supremacy groups.
That's why skinheads were brought in under question.
Yeah, because it's quite evident that there is a particular type that they're going after.
The Temarema Three were convicted of the murder and were sentenced to 20 years in prison, meaning they were eligible to get out in 2012. And we have another quote here, this time from World Queer Story.
Despite the fact that one of those teenagers was reported saying to the police, "The easiest thing with a cliff is just herding them over the edge," the police didn't even begin investigating the rash of murders. Which, so right there, that's condoning the action,
mm-hmm.
Right? There is no... If you're a detective worth your salt and someone says to you, "It's really easy to herd people over a cliff," and you know for a fact that multiple people, multiple families continue to report and continue to be the victims of falling from that particular cliff, if you're not opening an investigation, you are being complicit.
Mm-hmm.
And no one is going to be able to convince me otherwise based on this sort of evidence. It is incredibly damning.
Ross Warren was a 25-year-old newsreader for Wynn Wollongong who travelled to Sydney with some friends and they'd gone out for drinks. On the night of July 21st, 1989, he was seen driving along Oxford Street in his Nissan Pulsar, heading for the eastern suburbs, possibly heading back towards the house of the friend he was staying with.
And for a lot of people who don't know, Oxford Street in Sydney is also a gay beat.
Mm-hmm.
Has been for a while. Gay strip clubs, gay brothels.
I found out an interesting thing. I don't remember if I put in the notes or not, but there were gay nightclubs in Oxford Street opened up 30 years before the first straight one.
Oh, wow.
So it was definitely a gay beat.
Absolutely it was. It's always been known as one.
Mm-hmm. When Ross didn't show up for work on Monday, the search for him began. His keys were found at the base of a cliff at Marks Park 2 days after he went missing. His car was found nearby earlier that day and is what led his friends to search the area for signs of him. Police under Sergeant Ken Bowditch decided after 4 days of having an open case that the boy died of an accident stepping off the cliff in the dark.
And then mysteriously walked back up the cliff after dying and parked his car somewhere else and then threw his keys somewhere else and then jumped back into the water.
They closed the case, figuring that the body would eventually surface from the sea within the next few days. With Ross Warren being such a public figure, it's insane that they closed the case that fast.
And we can actually say that with 100% certainty because when we covered the family murders, the son of a famous news anchor disappeared and a massive investigation was opened. In fact, he was the catalyst for opening the family murders investigation. We know for an absolute certainty that a high-profile investigation was started in exactly the same fashion. However, you have two very different outcomes here.
Mm-hmm. Ross's body was never recovered. Alongside John Russell and Guy Mattaney, Ross's case was reopened by Deputy Coroner Millage in a 2003 inquiry into police bias. The case has, of course, yet to be solved. Ross went over the same cliff where Critchcorn was thrown 364 days later.
You would have to imagine that if the Temarema 3, I mean, it's obvious who did it. Like, seriously?
This would be the third case involving them. It's obvious that this was a habit.
Yeah, it's obvious you're dealing with, I mean, come on, man. Like, Blind Freddy, one of my mother's favourite sayings, Blind Freddy could see who did this.
Mm-hmm. 50-year-old William Allen was a retired teacher at Newington College living on Newton Street in Alexandria. On December 28, 1988, he was beaten in the area of Alexandria Park and managed to stumble the 750 metres home. On the way there, he was spotted by a driver who noted he had blood on his hands and face, but he didn't stop to help.
I understand why people don't stop to help, mm-hmm. okay? At the end of the day, human nature is going to be you're going to protect yourself mm-hmm. first and foremost. And I understand it. I honestly do. I know people think that a lot of individuals are being callous, but imagine you're a driver, you see someone in that condition, you've got your wife next to you, you've got your kids in the back seat, you're going to make decisions.
The question-
Even if you were by yourself, you were still going to consider your safety first. And I have been in a position multiple times where I have pulled over. The last time being an incredibly stormy night, there was rain bucketing down everywhere. The person was pulled over, had the hazard lights on, and gave me some money to go get them some fuel. Now, I do not judge people for not stopping. Holly will often help strangers in need, and it panics the absolute crap out of me.
Especially I'm free for O right now, so I'm good.
Especially when they sit in the car and tell Holly about murders in Belengalo Forest. But we're not going to rehash that discussion, are we, Holly?
No.
But me and Holly do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm not going to judge anyone who doesn't either.
No, you see someone stumbling down the road with blood on his hands and face, you don't know if he's the one owning the blood or he's found the blood somewhere else.
Are you dealing with the culprit or are you dealing with the victim? And I understand it. And it's one of my favorite sayings is like, you know, just be careful of swinging that judgmental pendulum,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, it will swing back towards you too. So it's like, you know, if you're one of those people who are like, look, I'm absolutely going to stop for everyone. Good on you. Like, you're a champion, you're an absolute hero, and you're a legend. But I'm not going to blame people who don't.
No. The next morning, William Allen was found dead in his home. There was no evidence to immediately arrest anyone for the death. However, the police's motivations might not have been that clear-cut.
At the time of his murder, he was under investigation for cultivating and selling cannabis to young males for sex, was known to frequent a gay beat at Alexandria Park.
And that's the triad there, ladies and gentlemen.
Drugs, homosexual, gay sex.
Pedophilia.
Well, what's young men?
Well, it's definitely not going to be over 20 because they don't tend to call people young men over 20.
Yeah, but if that's an 18-year-old man, that is perfectly legal.
Generally,
if,
well, that's not what they call them.
Actually, what is a so it's quite interesting in Australia. If you have sex with a teenage girl who's 16, most states that's legal. However, if a person who is 18 and over has sex with a 16-year-old boy, that's actually still considered statutory rape until they're 18. Isn't that very interesting?
I could make many sexist comments here, but I won't.
We all could. So, yes, what in this...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Sphere, what does young men mean?
He's a teacher. That also gives weight towards the pedophilia idea. And also,
but they don't say young boys. They said young men, Holly.
I know, but I've also read more reports that weren't in here. I'm telling you right now, they were teenagers.
How old?
14, 15.
All right, pedophile. Well, simple as that. Like,
so there's your triad.
Like, honestly, makes it difficult because I really don't like pedophiles.
But he was only under investigation. It hadn't been proved yet, so you're not allowed to smack him yet.
Absolutely. So, obviously, when it comes to drug use in this country, around the world right now, cannabis is being legalized everywhere. It's been legalized in Canada. It's been legalized across all states in America. Slowly legalization is happening. Obviously, places like Amsterdam, it's been legal for many, many years. UK will probably follow suit. Drugs always seem to be a bigger naughty than throwing people off cliffs in this country. I can't quite understand why. Also, having grown up with people in those circles as well, trading sexual favors for drugs is something that happens a lot more than people think it does. Definitely something that people shouldn't be doing.
No. On January 15, 1990, Richard Johnson responded to a phone call at Alexandria Park, supposedly from a young man who wanted to hook up in the public toilets there. Now, in the old days before Tinder and Grindr or Facebook were a thing, in order for people to hook up, they had to write their phone number on the stall wall.
Was it Boy George who got caught, or was it George Michael got caught soliciting?
Yeah, Boy George beat someone up. George Michael solicited.
Yeah, George Michael solicited a police officer in a public toilet. So public toilets were a hookup spot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very hygienic person. I don't like the idea of that.
A group of teenage boys nearby had just finished a game of basketball and found themselves bored as the summer night settled in. One of the boys suggested they have a game of poofter bashing instead. They went to the toilet block in Alexandria Park and picked a random phone number scrawled on the wall. When Johnson arrived, the teenagers ran towards him and knocked him to the ground, surrounding him. They took turns punching and kicking him in the chest and head until they grew bored, then left him fatally wounded on the ground.
It was 1990, and when interviewed by detectives the following month and asked why the attack was carried out, the eldest of the boys simply replied, "Because he was a fag."
While police were lackluster in their investigation of the murder, they did eventually find themselves some culprits. The eight teenagers that were arrested came to be known as the Alexandria Eight.
Homicide detective Steve McCann secretly recorded conversations the boys had with each other and other inmates. They bragged about killing gay men at the cliffs at Bondi Beach.
Two of those eight teenagers were also recorded talking about the murder of William Allen. However, the evidence they discussed was contradictory and useless to investigators. Police are sure that some members of the eight killed the man, but they can't actually prove it.
It's horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
That's so two gangs of children beating people up.
Yeah, that's... And you can only imagine what kind of homes they came from. So already there you've got... We've got two decent culprits who quite possibly have... I mean, who knows? Maybe they even knew each other.
Oh, one of the boys was members of both groups.
Well, there you go. And that's also, we're now looking at 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
That screams to me that there is something far more sinister going on than just 10 boys who are homophobic.
There were also some members of the Alexandria Eight were part of the Bondi Boys, which makes three gangs of...
Yeah, I don't think we're talking...
For lack of term.
Yeah, I really hate that. I hate all those words.
That's because you know what the history behind them is.
Of course, and it brings back unpleasant memories. God, I'd wager to say that we're not really dealing with three separate gangs here. We're dealing with a collective.
Mm-hmm.
Screams neo-Nazi.
Simon Blair Walk was found floating in Sydney Harbour on January 11, 1990. A passenger on the Manly ferry noticed the naked body bobbing in the water near Bobroyd Head and called it to the harbour master's attention. He'd been missing since January 9. Now, for those who don't know Sydney, you'll probably need a little bit of a layout here. Dobroyd Head is the inner heads of Sydney. So Stephen Johnson went over on the outside of the North Head. Travelling inwards, the next rock jutting out on that side, on the other side of the route to Manly, is Dobroyd Head. So they're within less than a K of each other. His death was ruled as a suicide as he was on antidepressants following the breakup of an 8-year relationship. Definitely some waterproof reasoning there. Some clothes, possessions, etc. were found at the gap on the south head, but his father, Ian Walk, later said that they were not what Blair would normally wear. There was also bruising around his neck, which was sufficient to call for a second autopsy to determine cause of death. However, there was apparently no inquest needed.
Misadventure due to hardcore bondage sex, perhaps?
Then how did he end up in the water?
His lover got scared and threw him in.
Yeah, but
the reason I say that is because now we're all right. So what we know about motive and MO here, right? We've seen these gangs throwing people directly off the cliff, but we've never seen choking. Right? The attacks have been quick, vicious beatings, and then, as soon as the person is incapacitated, over the cliff for the final kill, right? This, the bruising around the neck, I find quite interesting. The reason I say that is because bruising around the neck is also often indicative of, it's often indicative of encounters of sexual assault. So, two possibilities here. And there's one of these I think is also quite probable. In conjunction to the gangs of young boys throwing people off cliffs here and murdering them because they're homophobic, there is also the distinct possibility that you're also dealing with a serial killer using the same area as a dumping ground, a sexual predator, a sexual sadist. And the bruising around the neck, very indicative of a crime like that.
I mean, I know some more worthy victims you could have gone after, but that's just me.
What do you mean by worthy? I'm not
the ones who were bashing up the gay people. They were more of a worthy target than what the gay people were.
Well,
from my moral side of this compass. Yes.
Well, Holly, sexual predators don't generally.
I know.
Outside of the ridiculously stupid television show and book series Dexter, generally speaking, sexual predators aren't also vigilantes.
I know. I'm just saying that there were more worthy victims out there for him. That's all.
I mean, there are more worthy victims for every single serial killer out there. There were more worthy victims for Ivan Milat, but that's generally not the kind of victim that they traffic in.
The coroner declared Blair died by multiple injuries consistent with a great fall, but could not actually conclude suicide. Blair was confirmed gay, which probably explains police apathy towards this particular case. Ian Walk, his dad, told the coroner that Blair told him that someone was trying to kill him, but didn't say who. An inquiry into the tides and currents of the area at the time of his death, undertaken by his family because the police had dusted their hands of it, indicated there was no way his body could actually float from the South Head, where his possessions were found, and end up on the north side of the harbour. It just wasn't physically possible. It is possible that it was dragged along in the wake of passing ships, but any ship that moved close enough to pull it in on its wake would have spotted it and would therefore have been close enough to determine it was a body, like the Manly Ferry person did. Not enough harbour traffic happens at night for it to be hidden by the cloak of darkness.
Yeah, but there is always the outside possibility of a million different things that could have put that body in the different location. However, very improbable.
Mm-hmm.
Improbable. Unprobable. Improbable. Improbable. I'm going to go with that one.
Improbable. That right. Blair's body was, however, found not far from Reef Beach, a confirmed gay beat with known gay bashings taking place in the area. That's on the north side, quite near Dobson Head. Were the possessions found actually Blair's? Was there an actual suicide that went missing, which is yet to be reported? This case remains unsolved, though Strikeforce Parabel has contacted the Wark family to talk about it.
I think it's quite interesting here because there always has been the suggestion as well that not only were there hate groups operating and committing these murders, but there were also a known serial killer. Now, what's also interesting about this is we know for a fact that Mr. B, who was a star witness, in the case against Von Einem after the family murders, frequently moved between Adelaide and Sydney. Eventually, Mr. B, after being granted immunity to be a witness in that case, would eventually relocate full-time to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite possible that police moved one dangerous sexual sadist from one city to another.
We've finally reached the end of the cases we're going to cover here, but this one's by far the most, not most famous in of the case, but he's definitely a famous person.
And it's also important to note here, especially if we have victims, family listening to these, if we have missed someone, it's not because we deemed people more important than other people. It's more about having more information on particular cases.
Yeah.
And so that's why we've selected the ones that we have. Otherwise, this podcast series would go for 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10 episodes.
We can't do that to ourselves.
Well, it's important that, you know, we often find that people will shut down or shut off if there is too much information given on something. So, you know, we've highlighted these particular cases because they do represent a cross-section of all the possible cases. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, again, if we haven't mentioned a particular case, it's not out of malice, it's not out of ignorance. We have selected these for important reasons, not to say that every single case isn't important. But this is the last case that we're going to cover before we conclude this series.
At about 1 a.m. on December 23, 1993, 41-year-old Crispin Dye was touristing his way around Sydney on a visit from his home in Cairns, Queensland. He was out with friends, celebrating the release of his first CD, A Heart Like Mine, under the stage name Chris Kemp.
Crispin and his friends left the Gilligan's nightclub and were walking down Little Oxford Street in Surrey Hills towards the Flinders Hotel. From there, Crispin headed off at about 3 a.m, heading towards the Courthouse Hotel, where he was refused service around 4. He stumbled from the hotel and headed out into the night. At 4:35 a.m, he was found in Little Oxford Street, only a few doors up, with major head injuries. Crispin was bashed and robbed, reportedly by 3 men of Pacific Islander appearance, but that is only inference, as these men were apparently seen going through his wallet after the attack.
Which could also mean that they happen to be opportunistic thieves.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it when this happens. I don't know which is worse, the people who commit the initial crime of knocking the fuck out of someone or those disgusting bottom feeders that then see someone who is in desperate need of medical attention and then proceed to rob them. I mean, honestly, they all fit in the same disgusting boat, don't they?
Mm-hmm. And we have a quote here from the Sydney Morning Herald.
A witness told police he saw 3 men aged in their late teens to early 20s and possibly of Pacific Islander appearance standing over Dine and rifling through his wallet as he lay bleeding in the dark lane before they ran north towards Goulburn Street. 2 of the men were wearing baggy, long pants and T-shirts, while the 3rd man was dressed in a baggy knee-length shorts, a white T-shirt, joggers with white socks and a dark baseball cap.
Police and ambulances were called to the scene and he was rushed to St. Vincent's Hospital. He was transferred to St. George Hospital for specialist treatment but succumbed to his injuries on Christmas Day.
Police are seeking information on the last movements of a Queensland tourist who died in a Sydney hospital on Christmas Day after apparently being bashed. Police said Crispin Wilson Dye, 41, from Cairns, was last seen by friends who left him drinking at Darlinghurst Club on December 23rd. He was found unconscious in the street and died later in hospital. Police said a passerby had seen 3 men standing over the body. They appeared to remove something from the body before running from the scene, a spokesman said. We've since established his black leather wallet containing ID and a sum of cash is missing.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, Dye is best known as the manager of AC/DC and worked with the Easy Beats and Rose Tattoo. The attack on the man wasn't actually immediate news. I didn't find a single reference to the event while researching our AC/DC episodes.
Dye had spent several years managing AC/DC, during which he helped the group become one of the world's biggest rock bands. A gold record he received for his work on the band's 1985 album, Fly on the Wall, hung in the lounge room of his winter home in Cairns at the time of his death. He lived the remaining half of the year with his mother in Willoughby.
Considering that the event was almost immediately passed off as a gay bashing due to its location on Little Oxford Street, it's not surprising that it didn't end up showing up in the news or in most information on the band. It's not something they would rush to publicise. AC/DC was still reeling from the bad publicity of the Salt Lake City incident where 3 teenagers died in 1991 and the legal repercussions they were still going through with it. They weren't about to go, "Also, our old manager got beaten up and killed walking a gay part of Sydney a couple of days before Christmas 93.
Yeah, yeah, it was an incredibly tumultuous time for the band. And of course, like, you know, not only that, but, you know, they'd lost a member to alcohol, you know, choking on his own vomit mm-hmm. only a few years before that. Yeah. So this was another friend that they'd lost. So, yeah, I would imagine it would have been a rough situation. Not only that, too, having a gay friend, you know, some people would have seen that in a negative light. So I've never encountered the band talking about it.
No.
I've never seen it in interviews. I'm not saying that they haven't. I just haven't encountered it.
We have another quote here from the Sydney Morning Herald.
Police files at the time had listed the attack on Di as a possible gay hate crime following a spate of assaults and murders of homosexual men in the preceding years. However, at a press conference on Wednesday, Superintendent Willing, while confirming that Di was gay, said all the circumstances pointed to a robbery as the motive for the attack, given there were other attacks around the same time by people matching the description of the suspects.
So this is one of those cases where they don't know whether it was a gay hate or not, but they're willing to lean towards not.
Yeah. I mean, if they're looking at gay men in Oxford Street because they feel that they'd be cashed up,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they're targeting people because they're gay in Oxford Street and probably cashed up. So it doesn't really matter, does it?
And drunk, so it's easier to knock them down.
Yep.
Oxford Street was regarded as a gay part of town in the 80s and 90s until straight clubs started opening there in the 2000s. I did put it in the notes. Thus, anyone who was walking down that street had to have been a fag and was fair game for a beating, according to their logic. Jean Dye, Crispin's mother, however, stated that he wasn't gay, though he was perceived as such sometimes. While it's accepted that the evidence of this was a gay hate crime is in contention, one has to wonder if it wasn't a case of people preying on gays, often seen as weaker men, in order to take their money. Working the gayest street in Sydney is definitely going to expose you to such a crowd, and it's possible that Crispin, not being from Sydney, could have said or done something wrong to make the perpetrators panic, and they seized the opportunity while he was down to take his money and ID.
Jean Dye told Fairfax Media last year she was not convinced that gay hate was the motive, although she could not rule it out. He had many girlfriends, his mother said, though he had told her, "People say I'm gay, Mum, but I don't know what I am." After the inquest, a policeman had told Mrs. Dye that a prisoner had been captured in a street recording saying that he had knocked off Dye, but that lead came to nothing. Mrs. Dye was then unhappy to learn that a police reward for information had long since lapsed. "Someone out there knows what happened," she said.
Now, the case didn't move over the next 20 years, in spite of a 1994 inquest into the death. In 2014, a $100,000 reward was posted for information on what happened, but no one has apparently come forward.
There are people out there who know who's responsible for Mr. Dye's death, and we're hoping this reward may prompt them to get in touch with police, Detective Superintendent Mark Willing explained in a statement. By all accounts, Crispin Dye was a fun-loving, friendly and decent man who was robbed of his life far too soon. We're absolutely committed to getting to the bottom of this case and bringing those responsible for an innocent man's violent death to justice. But we won't be able to do it without assistance from the public.
And there you go, we're done.
And that concludes our series on the gay hate murders that had occurred in Sydney. Now, at the risk of sounding didactic and talking down to people, which please believe me, my statements come from genuine places. At the start of this series, I mentioned how people get very, very upset about political correctness. They buy into culture war arguments. And it is leading us down very dark paths. It's important to remember that only 20 years ago, homosexuals in Australia were considered so less than human that beating one up, throwing them off a cliff, murdering them was considered culturally acceptable by the mainstream. And I think that's really important to remember. Every time we hear a silly argument about a sign being changed on a toilet door, and every time you want to get angry about it, I really, really want you to think back on these episodes. I personally don't believe that anyone who's listened to Weird Crap in Australia for this long could possibly be, you know, homophobic. I really don't. I think our audience is wonderful. But it's really, really important to think about these things. Political correctness may get silly at times. I will be the first to admit that. You know, I've heard some pretty crazy shit over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, Holly. I would rather let people do crazy things like refer to themselves as Star Children or some other dragon reincarnated from outer space. I would rather have that. All right. Than my friends in the homosexual community being taken to the edge of a cliff, beaten, and then thrown to their deaths. And that's really all I have to say on it.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much for sticking with us on this. It's been a rough one, but it's an important story. I'm glad you've been able to sit through it. There is some good news coming up, though. While these sort of things were occurring, Australia was also having somewhat of a cultural revolution. And that starts with a little movie called Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
No, the full title is The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Thank you for that correction, Holly, because no doubt people would have hit me hard with it. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to start exploring Australia becoming more accepting of people within the LGBT community. We're going to be talking about this sort of global phenomena that has become a stage show, musical, a Broadway musical, and it is in itself really, it kickstarted Australia's love of drag queens.
I mean, personally, I think that it inspired RuPaul's drag, whatever the fuck it is.
100% it did. It had to have. But this Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is to Australian pop culture. Sorry.
Same level.
Let me fix that, yep, that statement, actually. I put Mad Max, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Crocodile Dundee into the same category of pop culture and Australiana, you know, and the impact it had around the world.
Do you remember what year Mad Max was released in?
No.
Okay. I'm going to look it up. Probably a long time.
Well, actually, Holly, save that, table it,
yeah,
because we're going to get into that more in the next episode. So let's show both sides of what was going on. While these horrible things were happening, there was also a cultural revolution and acceptance was on the way, and it starts with that film. We're going to go into some amazing trivia. Holly loves this movie, so this is going to absolutely be a passion project for her. I've never watched it. Well, I've watched bits and pieces, but I have a very vague recollection of it, so I'm going to rewatch the film.
I watched it tonight.
If you're a fan of it, I think you're going to enjoy these episodes, and yeah, that's coming up next week, so dust off those tiaras and get those feather boas ready.
You know what I liken it to? I liken it to
a stop. Save fine. It for next episode, fine, Holly. Fine.
You're the one that brought it up.
I did because I want to help. I want people to know that there is also some good coming on the way. So I figured that we need to sort of lift people up.
I'm starting a notepad so I can just add all this stuff in.
Yeah, I'm gonna stop it before she blows it all for before we get to the episode.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us, of course. Don't forget, a lot of the cases that we did mention over these last three episodes, a lot of them are unsolved. So don't forget, if you do know something, if you know someone who knows something, make sure to send that information to the police. They have reformed. They do want to solve these crimes. Crime Stoppers is the place to go to make sure that we can, try and solve some of these cases. That applies to all the unsolved cases that we've mentioned on the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. If you do know something, Crime Stoppers is the place to go to get that information to the police. If you'd like to keep the conversation going, don't forget of our social media accounts, Facebook. You can find us under Weird Crap in Australia, both on Facebook and Instagram. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Weird Crap in Oz, AUS, and you can shoot us a good old-fashioned email. A lot of people like to do that. As we mentioned in previous episodes, if you do send us information that we think would be relevant to an ongoing case, we will send that to the police, so just be aware of that. But if you just like to chat with us, if you just like to shoot us a fan email and wanting to get a response, because either we'll respond via the podcast or we'll respond with another follow-up letter, please do so. Shoot those through to us at weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. Don't forget, we do have our next book coming out, Weird Crap in Australia Volume 2. We'll be hitting shelves September 1st. We're actually currently discussing having these in a store, our first store in Australia. So that's going to be something exciting to announce. You can pick up a copy of Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1 right now from lulu.com. And you can also get the digital edition from amazon.com. You can also find some Weird Crap in Australia merchandise from our Redbubble store. Head to redbubble.com, type in Weird Crap in Australia, or head to weirdcrapinaus.redbubble.com. Select your design, all courtesy of the amazingly talented Ignacio, who has been our Weird Crap artist now for a couple of years. And I don't know if we've mentioned it on the podcast before, but him and his partner, Viana, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Ignacio. You know I'm really bad with pronunciations, but they've welcomed their first child, Esther, into the world. So from all of us here, and I'm sure from the Weird Crap in Australia community, we'd like to congratulate you, Ignacio, on the first Weird Crap in Australia baby.
Yay.
Yay, good job, man. You beat us to the punch, and we're the hosts.
we've been part of this group longer than you have.
So, yeah, just a you know, heartfelt congratulations. We wish, of course, all the best for baby Esther. I'm sure he's going to do exciting things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watch this space, as they say, Holly. otherwise, we also have our Patreon. Don't forget, Patreon funds go directly to research materials. It goes directly to equipment. Head to patreon.com, type in Weird Crap in Australia, and for as little as $5 a month, you will get a bonus mini-sode that we release every week discussing current events here in the land of Oz. So if you're curious about what is going on here with COVID-19, for example, we cover those sort of things on those mini-sodes. As I said, only $5 a month, which is less than a cup of coffee a week. And those funds, of course, go to producing more episodes of The Thing You Love. And, of course, we release all mainline episodes of Weird Crap in Australia ad-free in the same Patreon feed. Really easy to set that up for you. You could do it exactly the same way you're doing it right now. And that's all the plugging I have in me right now. Like to hand it over, of course, to our wonderful researcher extraordinaire for the final words of the episode.
No, I'm just going to reiterate, if you know something, please tell someone.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with that that sentiment, Holly. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. Don't forget, we have more weirdness around the corner for you next week, because we never take a break. Please stay safe out there. I know it's going to be chaos for a little while, but we got this. We just got to work together.
By the time this comes out, we should be done with this.
I hope so. I really, really do. Anyway, folks, all my love and wishing you all the best out there. And we will see you again for another episode of Weird Crap in Australia next week. Bye for now.
See ya.
This has been a production of The Modern Meltdown. For more podcasts just like it, head to themodernmeltdown.net.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.